now Adar. And in a couple of days' time, we're entering the month of Adar, second Adar, which is the month of Purim. So Kabbalistically, there are some very amazing ideas connected with what this particular month is. Last time, I think we spoke about women and the month, Rosh Chodesh, and how the months correspond, or how the Rosh Chodesh, how the changing of a month corresponds to why it's a special time for women. Let's see if we can understand now this particular month and see what we can learn about the personality from it. Now, to do this, we'll have to look at some Kabbalistic ideas. These are things that we usually prefer not to talk about too much, but I think these days there's perhaps reason to do it more. There's such a lot going around that's being sold as if it were Kabbalah, which is just actually a pathetically cheap version of the subject. See if we can give it some dignity. That's been confused for a supermarket. So we have an idea like this. Kabbalistically, there's an idea that every month is connected to certain forces, certain energies, let's say. One way we can trace that, the central idea or the place where you find this, is a book that's called Sefer Yetzirah. Sefer Yetzirah means the book of formation. It's a very interesting Kabbalistic book that we understand actually was written in the days close to the beginning of the world. Tradition is that it was written by Abraham. He wrote that book himself. And the book tells you, one of the themes that run through that book is the idea of the correspondence of how these energies all correspond. For example, it takes there the letters of the alphabet, and shows what each letter corresponds to in terms of the body, in terms of the energies in the body, in terms of organs. And one of the things it does, it takes the months of the year. And through the months, it shows you, in fact, I once met a man who's very involved in Kabbalistic study in Jerusalem, and he had taken the whole Sefer Yetzirah and made a chart out of it. The work of genius. He had taken the whole book and he made a chart. He had written down all correspondences of 3, of 7, and of 12. You're aware that those are all mystically significant. One of them is an expansion of 12. There are 12 letters in Aleph Beis that are called pshutos. That means simple letters. They can't be doubled. They have no final form. They don't have dots in them. Simple, straightforward letters, 12 of those. There are 12 months, 12 tribes of the Jewish people, 12 organs in the body that correspond to them, 12 powers in the body like laughter, walking, other powers. And he made a chart out of the whole book as to how all these 12, how each of them corresponds to all the other things in the whole system, which signs of the zodiac, and so forth. Now, with that idea, that has to be dealt with in more detail some other time to understand the whole concept, but that's enough for us to already understand that if you take any particular, let's say, month, you want to understand something about Adar, about this month, you have to understand where it is in the system, where it lies on that plane of 12 different things, and then you could see what it corresponds to. And by doing so, you could learn a lot about the world, about the Jewish world, and you could learn a lot about the personality, and about yourself and your own weaknesses, maybe, and strengths. Because these 12 things actually are powers, what are called kochas ha-nefesh also. Just like they are corresponding to certain elements in the zodiac, they also correspond to certain kochas ha-nefesh. It means you have certain powers that correspond to each of these. And it could be that in that month, it could be that that thing is particularly strong, and it could be that in certain parts of a certain experience, could be you could use certain of these elements. That might sound a bit vague. Let's see if we can make it more specific and understand. If you look through the system, you'll find a very interesting thing, that the month of Adar is the last month of the year. According to the way the Torah talks about it, we call it the last month of the year before Nisan. Nisan is the springtime when Pesach happens, which is when everything is being formed or born or reborn, just like we went out of Egypt then and became the Jewish people, just like it says that the wheat and the produce starts growing in Nisan. That's the springtime in the northern hemisphere in Israel. So the month that precedes it, Adar, obviously must be the last month. That's the month that we're about to enter now. The month that's the last month in the year that has Purim. Now that has to be understood. What is the connection between Purim, which is a very strange idea? Purim is the idea of a disaster. It turns around into exactly the opposite. Benafachu. Purim is the idea of a decree promulgated against the Jewish people that at the last minute turns around and exactly what was intended to be done to us is done to the people who try to do it to us, and we end up having a the highest day of the year, actually, in many ways, Kabbalistically, Purim. Purim, actually, Kabbalistically, is one of the if not the highest day of the year. Not even higher than Yom Kippur. In fact, in many Kabbalistic places, it says that Yom HaKippurim, Yom Kippur, is Kep Purim. It's like Purim. That means it just manages to sort of approximate Purim. But actually, Purim is the highest day, because what you can achieve through happiness, through Simcha on Purim, through this a surprised laughter of seeing what looked like a disaster actually turn out to be a bracha, what you can achieve in that experience actually is as great or greater than a day of intense fasting and self, you know, examination and mortification on Purim. Amazing idea. On Yom Kippur. So therefore, we have a very strange thing, that this strange turnaround happens in the last month of the year. So what's being suggested here is that you have a year that's declining, it's going towards its end, and as it's about to disappear, what happens in that month, in the middle of the month, the peak of that month, the 14th, 15th of the month of Adar, the peak always where the moon is full in that month, you have then a turnaround that changes what looks like a dad into disaster, suddenly turns around, and that ending becomes a bracha, becomes the salvation of the Jewish people. And it says many places, not only that it's higher than Yom Kippur, it says that when the Torah was really received, because at Sinai when the Torah was received, it was forced on us. But at Purim, when there was complete darkness, and no one forced us to see the hand of Hashem, Purim was a series of political events. The king did this, and Haman did that, and Esther did this, but you don't see Hashem at all. In fact, the Megillah of Purim doesn't mention Hashem's name ever, not once. The only book of the Bible, the only book of the Tanakh, that doesn't mention Hashem's name at all. Complete darkness. And yet in that darkness, which looked like strange political events, as Jews always see things swirling around them that look like very difficult to understand, unstable political and social events, to understand that those actually are Hashem trying to tell us something, and it was because the Jewish people saw that in that darkness that it says they actually received the Torah, then they ratified it, they made it theirs, and that's considered the day that we really received the Torah. Until then it was forced on us, but that day is when we achieved it and we received it voluntarily. Now, all these forces are going through this month called Adar, connected with the idea of Purim. So let's see, what does it correspond to? What does it correspond to understand where it corresponds in the cosmic system? Take one or two of those correspondences. Let's see if we can feel out something, understand something about it. Well, if you look at the tribes, the Shvatim, the tribes of Israel, of the 12 tribes, you'll see a very interesting thing. Which tribe, which of the 12 tribes does Adar correspond to? Now that's very interesting to look at. The truth is that there are different ways to see this. The Sefer Yetzirah, the book that I mentioned before, and other Kabbalistic sources, the Gaon of Vilna, Arizal, other Kabbalistic sources list the 12 in different orders. There's more than one order in which to list these 12 tribes. One of the classic ways to do it is the order of their birth, from oldest to youngest. But there are other ways to do it. One of the ways that it's conventionally done also is according to the way they moved through the desert. You know, when they moved in the Sinai desert for 40 years in the Midbar, so there they camped according to what's called the Degoli. That there were four groups of three tribes surrounding the Mishkan, and it was very, very carefully worked out who camped at which place. First was Degel Machane Yehuda. The tribe of Yehuda went first. Three tribes that formed that encampment, they went first. Then there was Reuven, then there was Ephraim, and the last one was Degel Machane Dan. Dan was the rear guard who followed the three tribes of Dan that followed at the end. They were like the protection from the back, always the protection of the weakest, was the tribe of Dan. But they were last of the last. The end of Machane Dan, the third one of those three that were at the back, was Naphtali, the tribe of Naphtali. Now, we have to work out what exactly is the correspondence. What's unique about this? You can understand what these tribes were, what these great men were. The great sons of Yaakov, the 12 sons, what they were, what they represented spiritually, then we could understand what that tribe was and what it does in the Jewish people. And if you could understand what it does in the Jewish people, you could understand that part of your own neshama. Because each of us actually is a fragment of the whole Jewish people. So we have each of us in our own personality. Of course, if we knew which tribe we came from, if you knew which Shevet you came from, you could pick out very strongly your own. In fact, you might even be able to sense it. We don't know anymore whom we come from. We know that there are bits and pieces of all the tribes, although 10 of them were lost. But bits and pieces, fragments of them still are circulating among us. So if you're very sensitive to your own person, this does not mean looking in the Sunday papers for, you know, we're not talking about that. But nevertheless, there's a truth in that. If somebody knew what they were doing, certainly they could help you feel, or you could feel yourself if you're sensitive, exactly which of these 12 dimensions you come from, and you could feel a special work that you have to do in the world. Let's try and understand what are these end tribes that always come at the very end, right? if you go according to the order of the birth, the last one is Binyamin, obviously. Benjamin Binyamin. He was the last. He was born, Rachel Imenu died, giving birth to him, the 12th of the 12 Shvatim. He was the last one. What was unique about him, and how does he correspond to the whole idea of Adar and Purim? And then we may forget time, we try to look a little bit about Naphtali. What was he in the 12, in the system of 12? Why does he bring up the rear at the end of the last group, and how do they connect with each other? Now, the Kabbalistic idea is this, very difficult to understand, but a very beautiful thing, is that when you want to understand what these things mean, what they are, you look at what happened to the people. Look at what happened to Binyamin. What was his life? Although we understand that he had free choice to do what he wanted to do, but nevertheless what he ended up doing in his life, what happened to him, what was manifest through him in the world, is the Torah's way of showing you what that force is. We understand that, as we've explained many times before, that even though you choose what you want to do, but it fits into the destiny, that is actually what you have to do in the world. The only choice is whether you'll do it the hard way or the easy way. But in the end, you end up teaching what you have to teach in the world. And we understand that if you look at the life story, you look at the details of what happened to any of the avos, of the great personalities of Tanakh, you see that although it seems like they were faced with certain situations and they made certain choices, but at the end of the day they end up teaching perfectly consistently with what it is that they are in the world. What's unique about Binyamin? Let's try and see if we can understand it. What's the connection between Adar and Binyamin? So the first, obviously, is understanding that Adar is the last month. It's when the year draws to a close. It's when Kabbalistically the forces are spent. The forces are spent. It's like the year then is grinding down. Nisan is where the spring, the shoots appear through the ground, and everything starts to regrow. But Adar is the time of hopelessness. It's the time when the world looks hopeless. It's when the harvest has been already harvested long ago, nothing's yet regrown, and you see nothing growing. It's a very desperate and dangerous time. That's why we want to study it, because what's the Jewish response to situations of disastrous hopelessness? This is where we learn it. Because every experience, you go through many things in life that eventually run down. In fact, nothing remains constant. Everything you have, whether it's a marriage, a relationship, whether it's with children, but everything starts at a certain peak or peaks at a certain point and then tends to decline. And you have to be skillful and clever to be able to push through the period of darkness to see the spring the other side. And of course, the next spring should be higher than the one before. And so the whole thing should be an oscillation that's getting higher. But nevertheless, through the cycle, you always come to a point, and women know this very well, this is connected with the whole idea of the monthly cycle, as we tried to explain last time. Also, the trick is to build love and beauty on a higher pitch than it was before, and that's why the whole idea of a cycle, that's what it's based on. So now let's focus on that part of the cycle, which is the dive at the end. And Kabbalistically, you understand that when it gets worse, it suddenly gets much worse. It's not just that when you have the end of an experience, it sort of gradually declines. Not like that. It declines to a point where the energy is so low that then things start to dive disastrously, and then they go out of control. And it's in that, and of course, that's what happened. If you understand carefully, why was the decree of Haman? Why did he issue a decree that the Jews should all be destroyed? When did it happen? It says that he cast lots. And when the lot fell on Adar, when he saw that it was that month, he was ecstatic. But why? Because he knew that that's the end of the year for the Jewish people. And don't forget, in his day, there had been no Yontif then. There was no auspicious thing that ever happened to the Jewish people in Adar, whatever happened in Adar. Adar was an empty month, the end of the year, that had nothing. In fact, the only thing that happened on Adar was on the 7th of Adar, Moshe Rabbeinu died. The great inspiration of the Jewish people had died on the 7th of Adar. So Haman actually was ecstatic when the lot fell out. On Adar, he knew that it was the month in which Moshe died, in other words, where Torah stopped being given. That's surely the sign of the disaster of the Jewish people. So he decided to make his decree at the time, and of course, we don't have time to go through it all, but you have to work it out for yourself. Every time we talk about these events, if you translate it into your own terms, isn't it obvious? When do you get your biggest test? When you're weakest? Huh? Do you get your biggest test when you're going? Is it when you walk out the front door and say, right, I'm ready, let us have it, that you get some difficulty? Then with child's play, you stomp on it and grind it into a pulp. That's not what happens. It's when you're depressed and everything's going wrong, isn't that right? It's when you're depressed and everything's going wrong and you can't take anymore. That's when your biggest ordeals always hit you, when you're weakest, no question. And that's because the evil forces in the world, the forces, that's what they do. They wait for the lowest moment. Obviously, we're talking about intelligent forces here. We're talking about you. It's you who know yourself so well. It's you who gets yourself into these situations. It's not somebody else. And that negative side of you knows you inside out and knows when you're weakest. So the Haman is actually representing that force in the world that identifies that weakness and is able to do that. So when the Jewish people are at their weakest, they have nothing going for them. It's the last month in the year. They haven't quite made it to Pesach yet, which is the rebirth. And Moshe Rabbeinu died. And that's a tremendous sign of disaster. So in that month. But of course, Kabbalistically, it says that what Haman didn't know. It has to be always this way. Always has to be this. What Haman didn't know, see, it says that Moshe Rabbeinu died on the 7th of Adar. What Haman didn't know is that he was born on the 7th of Adar. That's what he didn't know. You see, the same date that has, and that's always an idea, great tzaddikim, it says, are always completing their life. Often born, die on the same day that their birthday was. It is an absolute completeness. Moshe Rabbeinu was taken on the 7th of Adar, but he was born on the 7th of Adar. So what Haman didn't realize was that the very day that seems outwardly to have the downfall element, the response of the Jewish people, is a message we have to understand, the response of the Jewish people to these things is always that we extract out of that disaster, we extract victory. It's not that we manage to bypass it or sort of somehow get away without it or somehow just survive it. That's not the way the Jewish people function, is that out of the impossible is where we draw our sustenance, as opposed to everybody else. We've looked at this idea in various ways before. Let's follow this through and see. So you have the last month where the sun is going down, where the energy is dipping, where disaster and despair, depression, all those things are gathering. At that time you have a child called Binyamin. Binyamin, very, very amazing child, person. Let's try and see how he fits in. Of course, I'm sure you're racing ahead of me as usual. The month of Adar is all Binyamin. I'm sure you realize that. The month of Adar, the problems of Adar were formed by Binyamin. Who was that? King Saul. Shaul was from the tribe of Binyamin. You remember that? And Saul, instead of killing Amalek when he was commanded to wipe out the people of Amalek, he left the king alive, Agag. Just one day he left him alive, right? He was supposed to wipe them out, which means spiritually, it means killing that, destroying that energy in the world, which is the distance between us and Hashem. Amalek are those people, the Haman people. Haman was a descendant of Amalek. Amalek are the people who try and kill the Jewish people and try and destroy what we do spiritually in the world. Saul, King Saul, Shaul HaMelech, was given the chance to wipe out Amalek. But he couldn't bring himself to wipe them out entirely. And so he left, Kabbalistically, he also left a few animals alive. And there the Kabbalists say that actually they were people transmuted into animal form. But anyway, the point is that he left the king Agag alive. The next day when Shmuel, the prophet, Samuel, saw Agag alive, he criticized Saul for doing it and he killed him on the spot. But the point is that the previous night he'd been with a woman in the camp and she was pregnant. And so although Amalek was killed, but the seed of Amalek was still in the world, and descended from that woman was Haman. Descendant from that one night that Agag was left alive, that Saul made a tragic mistake, was Haman, who almost succeeded in wiping out the Jewish people some generations later. So you see that the person who had this in his hand, the person who had it in his hand to destroy Amalek and bring the Messianic Age, because you have to understand that Binyamin is the last of the tribes. What's left after Binyamin? After you've been through all 12, and you come to the one who's absolute perfection like Binyamin, what's left? Only the Mashiach, only David. Only David is next. So there's always an idea of what's called a Mashiach ben Yosef. A Mashiach from the tribe, from the house of Yosef ben Yamin. Don't forget both of them, Joseph ben Yamin, were both born from Rachel. The only two children of Rachel Imenu. She was the one who brings them down into the world. It says Leah was a much higher concept, but Rachel is the one who... How much time we have to go into these things. But Rachel is the one who brings them down into the world. And she brings down a Yosef and a ben Yamin. The two parts of the final stage of giving birth to a child. And the next stage after that is just the birth of the child, which is the Messianic birth. And therefore it says that the Mashiach ben Yosef is the one from the house of Yosef ben Yamin. He's the one, actually the two of them go together. He's the one who brings in the Davidic, the Messianic, the line, the Mashiach ben David. In fact it says that if Saul had done his job correctly, if he had seen his job correctly and managed, I mean we're not criticizing him at his level of greatness, but at his level he made a mistake. Had he done his job correctly, he would have given over to David. Instead of hounding David and believing that he was an enemy, he would have, had he been able to reach his full perfection, he would have wiped out Amalek, prepared the way completely for the line of David, and would have given it over to David, because the Mashiach had to come from the house of David, not from Binyamin. And he would have given it over to him, bringing it full circle back to Yehuda. The leader of all the tribes, the one from whom the king comes, is Yehuda. And the work is always to close the circle. He would have brought the end, killed Amalek, done all that work at the end, prepared the way completely, and brought it all the way back to Yehuda, who would have given out to David, the David, who would have been the Mashiach, and would have been perfect. So the whole tragedy of Adar began with Binyamin, with the tribe of Binyamin, Saul, from that tribe, who made a mistake. And the whole tikkun, the whole perfection of Adar came from Binyamin. Who is Mordechai? Ish Yemini, from the tribe of Binyamin. Mordechai, whose Esther was in the palace, manipulating and maneuvering the whole situation to save the Jewish people, Mordechai was the one who, the two of them, saved the Jewish people in that disastrous decree when, for the only time ever, that all Jews on earth were in the power of one man and all destined for destruction. It's never happened since. Even in the worst Holocaust that have ever happened, there have always been at least a few Jews some other place who would have survived. But there was all known, all parts of the known world were all under the power of one man, right? Achashverosh. He was the king of 127 countries, which was the entire known world at the time, and every single Jew alive was in his power. So there was a decree of destruction against every single Jew on earth. And who managed to put it out of destruction was, again, the tribe of Binyamin. Now, to understand what is it in his personality, who was this young child who was born at the end of all the other brothers, who was the hope of the Jewish people? What exactly was it? So if you think about it, you'll see he had amazing characteristics. First of all, it says in the Gemara that he was the one of very few people who never sinned ever. Binyamin was a child, was a person. I think the Gemara lists four people over there, if I'm not mistaken. Binyamin was one of them who never sinned ever. Imagine that in his whole lifetime, he never sinned ever. And the Torah is talking at his level, not you know, allowing a few slips here and there at our level. That means absolute perfection. That is so rare that, to the best of my knowledge, only a few people who ever lived that the Torah could ever talk about that way. So you see, now what's the connection? Why is it that the one who comes at the end has to have absolute perfection? What's the connection between them? Also, you see that Binyamin, the name means the son of the right hand side. Ben Yamin, the son of the right. And if you remember correctly, when he was born, his mother called him Ben Oni. Benoni. That's where the name comes from. Ben Oni. They used to be very frum. The thing is that she called him Ben Oni, the son of power. Oni means my sadness, but it also means power, which is also the right hand side. Then his father changed his name, called him Binyamin, which is literally the son of the right. What is this thing about the son of the right hand side? What exactly does that mean? Why do they call a child that? The Kabbalists say it means this. Most people have a right and a left hand. They have both sides. But Binyamin was only the right hand side. It's a wonderful idea. He was only from the right. Again. And of course that's why, you see, the left hand side is always the side that stresses, that puts tension against the right. And then there's somehow some sort of balance that's formed between them. But the balance is formed by between being pulled to what's correct, or let's say right, and what's being pulled towards the left, or what's sinister or wrong. And then some sort of balance after some sort of battle is achieved. Binyamin never had a battle. He never was pulled to the left-hand side. He never had that ordeal. He didn't have a left-hand side. He was all perfection, all the right-hand side. See if you can try and understand this. By the way, there's a fantastic clue to this. It's just these ideas are so beautiful to understand. The Torah calls him Yedid Hashem, the beloved one of Hashem. When the blessings were given to the tribes, he's called Yedid Hashem, the blessed one, the very beloved close one. Yedid means a beloved friend. The beloved friend of Hashem, Yedid Hashem. And then when it talks about him, when the blessings are given, it says, Bein Kseifav Yishkon, between his shoulder blades, between his shoulders, the temple will rest. In other words, the land of Israel was divided up for all of the 12 tribes. Binyamin got a certain area, and in his area, in the middle of it, was where the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, had to stand. So it describes him as Yedid Hashem, the beloved one of Hashem, and it's between his shoulders. So the Kabbalistic, Arizal Kabbalistic commentaries, they say it means this. Yedid Hashem means the beloved one of Hashem. But if you read the word carefully, you can picture it in your mind in Hebrew. Yedid is Yad Yad. Two hands. Both hands the same hand. Isn't that beautiful? That means Ben Yamin, he's the son of the right hand side. So when the Torah talks about him, when his father talks about him, he calls him Yedid Hashem. Means the one who is only the right hand side. Yad, Yad. Two hands that are actually one hand. And of course, Ben Kseifav Yishkon, between his shoulder blades, means the perfect center always. Kabbalistically, between the shoulders is always considered to be the place where the right and the left meet. There is a perfect balance without any pulling to the left at all. The perfect center line. Instead of having to harmonize by having difficulties on both sides and working it out, he was already in that perfect center line. That's what Binyamin means. Now, why is this? Why is this? Why is this? And of course, if you think, we haven't got time, but look up the Midrashim yourself. Go through what it says. Read the Midrash. Read even in English, the Midrashim. You'll see every detail of his life fitted into this. I'll just give you one example. It says that, what could be a better example? It says that Haman sent to Mordechai. Do you remember what happened for him? Haman sent to Mordechai because Mordechai wouldn't bow down to him. Everybody bowed down to Haman, the whole, and on pain of death, and Mordechai refused to bow down. In fact, not only that, when Haman walked past, he stood up. Haman was the ruler of the whole, of everything, and he issued a death sentence on anyone who didn't pay him the respect of bowing down to him. And when Mordechai would find Haman, when he'd walk through the place, and Mordechai was the leader of the Jewish people, he sat in the gate. He sat where the Sanhedrin sat, he was in the gate, he was very visible. When Haman walked past, not only didn't he bow down like everybody else, he stood up to drive him crazy. He stood up absolutely, and it says that's how he destroyed him, and then he drove him out of his kalim, and eventually he made such bad judgments. Haman made such bad decision, such bad judgment that he eventually destroyed himself. That's how Mordechai overcame him. But when he refused to bow down, amazing, amazing thing. When he refused to bow down, so Kabbalistically the problem is this, that when a person has to show subservience, a very, very interesting idea, when the Jewish people have to show subservience to the non-Jewish forces, the anti-Jewish forces in the world, the Kabbalistic idea is that you shouldn't stand up to them. This doesn't mean that you should back down and do what's wrong. But if you have two options, one is standing up publicly and making a fight out of it, and the other is publicly not being seen to make a fight, but privately doing what's correct, the Jewish attitude, again, it's so hard to tell discussion in its own right, but the Jewish attitude is to walk between the raindrops. Right? There is another Jewish attitude, which is to stand up and fight and destroy all opposition, but that's only appropriate to us in the time when the kings, Jewish kings, rule. In the times of what's called the Tanakh period, when the world is run by Jewish kings, David, Solomon, they didn't bow and scrape to anybody. When anything, they ruled with an absolute iron Torah hand, and that's the way the world was run. But when the other side has the upper hand, there the Jewish attitude, what's called the Talmudic period, there and before it's returned to the Messianic phase where the king will be, where Torah will rule the world in a royal fashion, now the phase is that unfortunately the only way we can behave is by not making a friction or this is a very difficult thing to do because, especially since the rise of Israel as a state, it's a tremendous misconception in the world that the way to handle things is always to show that you are more aggressive and strong, which is not the Jewish way at all. The Jewish way is always to show whatever they want on the outside. That's irrelevant. What's relevant is if a job gets done. That's a practical Jewish attitude. To make a whole stand about showing power, where all it does is engender more hatred, that's not a clever way to handle things. The reason Jews make the mistake is because there is truth in it. Because at our highest point, that is the way we have to conduct ourselves. But anyway, where's the root of all this? The root of all this is because when Esau came to meet Jacob, when Esau came to meet Yaakov, Yaakov bowed down 7 times. That's what happened. In order to appease him, he sent him gifts. Remember that? And Esau was coming towards him with 400 men and intent on wiping him out. So Yaakov did all sorts of things. He sent angels in front to try and appease him and to frighten him. But in the end of the day, he bowed down to him 7 times. And because he bowed down, so now the commentaries say that now we can't get away with it any other way. Only when things are perfect will we be able to do it another way. But because he put that force into the world, we also have to behave in such a fashion. Okay, we're not going into detail where it's appropriate and where it's not, but that's the general idea. So this is what happened. When Haman walked through the gates and Mordechai saw him, instead of bowing down, he stood up to inflame him. And that's not the pathway. It says, Eretz Nitna B'Yad Rosha, the world is given into the hand of the evil. That's the way it is. The world in the, and do you need any proof of it? Does anyone need any proof of it these days? That the world is given into the hands of evil people. That means they run the show in absolute authority, and there's not even any way of suggesting that things should be done any different. Anybody stands up with righteousness, you can absolutely see. Of course, and the greatest evil of them are those who work in the name of what they call righteousness. But I mean, it's so obvious that the world, Eretz Nitna B'Yad Rosha, that's the thing you have to remember. The world is handed over into the hand of complete evil forces. Now, if that's true, so you can't stand up. It says that the shoe will always be on that foot. If you stand up to Rosh in that way, and you cause conflict where you don't have to, definitely you won't win. There's no question. The whole world is streaming along with their stream. The Purim at the end will be where the whole thing's turned around. But right now it's not turned around. So how come Mordechai felt that he could stand up to Haman and make him even more crazy? Much more dangerous. In fact, the Jewish people of that generation, they said to Mordechai, you're endangering our lives. By being so stubborn, so obstinate, being so dafka in this way, you are inflaming him, and that's what happened. And he got so inflamed that he made a decree to wipe them all out. What happened? It's like this. Kabbalistically, the reason is because Mordechai was called a Tzadik Gomer. Tzadik Gomer means a complete and utter righteous individual, which means this. The Kabbalistic sources make a distinction between somebody who's a Tzadik, which means righteous, and somebody that's Tzadik Gomer. Tzadik Gomer means somebody who is so righteous that he doesn't have a fleck of a mistake anywhere. Tzadik Gomer, complete tzadik. That means that if you're a tzadik, it means you could be righteous. You could be virtually perfectly righteous, but the world's given into the hand of evil forces, and if you try and stand up against it, it will find out that crack in you, and that will take away the merit that you have, and you won't be able to survive. But if you're a tzadik Gomer, that means you have no crack anywhere. You live on a level of absolute total perfection. You can stand in the face of whatever you want, and nothing will be able to touch you. Obviously. Where? Because it's only your own weakness that can destroy you. It's not somebody else who can destroy you. It's not a Haman who can destroy you. The only reason a Haman can destroy you is if you have some weakness. So when the accusation comes from the side of a Haman, the spiritual forces will seek out where your fractures are, and you'll fall apart along the fracture lines. But if you have no fracture lines, then no matter how wicked an individual and how negative the energy is, it couldn't do you any harm at all. And Mordechai knew. Why was Mordechai a tzaddik gomel? He was from the house of Binyamin. He is from the tribe, from the house of Binyamin, whose tradition was absolute perfection. So he knew he could do it. So this is what happened. Knowing that he could do it, and was the only way to save the Jewish people, even though it looks crazy, which is what Purim is all about, it looks exactly the opposite way. Mordechai stood up in front of Haman. So Haman sent him a message as follows. The Medrash records it. Why don't you bow down to me, since your grandfather bowed down to my grandfather? You hear that? This is Haman. He knew his Tanakh. He knew his stuff, Haman. He was no beginner. He wrote to Mordechai and he said, listen, I don't understand you. Yaakov, your grandfather, your great-great-grandfather Yaakov, he bowed down 7 times to Esau. You know, that's a very good priest. He said, why don't you just do what your grandfather, what's the problem? I'm not asking anything new from you. Just show me the honor and I'll let you go. I won't have any problems with you anymore. You follow? I'm not asking you to do something unheard of. Yaakov decided that that was the way to be. Yeah, good, not bad. Kadesh. The left-hand side in Hebrew is always called evil. You're aware probably that the word small in Hebrew, if you spell it out, it spells the name of the angel of destruction. The word small, if you read, you just change the vowels, pronounce it differently, which you don't even like to do, that's the angel of destruction, of doom, because it's there. It is the power of the left-hand side. When you get down there, you're getting so close to the danger zone that two things have to happen. One is that the energies are so bad, are so negative, that you have to have at that point absolute perfection. If you get down there to that point and you don't have perfection there, there's no hope at all. The only way you can say, and therefore Kabbalistically what happened was the Jewish people were given the child who was born at that time who's all the right hand side. He was, even if you put him right on the left, he's only the right hand. You follow? He could stand in that place of terrible, terrible negativity where all the forces are damaging, where all that happens that month is a decree for the destruction of the Jewish people. But in that place, the person who looks after us, the rear guard, we said, remember, he's the one who comes last. Just like the Machaneh, we won't have time today to go into Dan and Naphtali. But they're the ones who come at the very end. The ones who come at the end have to be the strongest. Samson, Shimshon, you know who he is born from? The tribe of Dan. Shimshon was from Dan. He was the one who was able single-handedly to almost become the Mashiach. Yaakov Avinu thought he'd be the Mashiach. He just didn't make it. He was the one who comes at the end where things are so bad that you need a Superman. Binyamin was that superhuman. He was a person who was only the right-hand side. You could put him in a world. And you see it, Yosef and Binyamin, the two brothers who came from Rochel, they were always like that. Yosef, if he ever made a mistake in his life, it must have been almost never. He was the one who could stay in the house of Potiphar's wife, you remember? For a year, and be tempted while she tried to seduce him. Day after day after day, with the most powerful enticements, physical and spiritual, and he was able to stand in that. Even when it cost his life at the end, he thought he was running out without his clothes, she took his, that it looked like he'd be destroyed, even that he was able to do. So the Yosef is always the one. That's always the area. If you want to know Kabbalistically, we'll have to finish in a minute or two. If you wish to know Kabbalistically, the end point is always the point of the connection between man and woman. That's always what it is. The beginning is always in the head, which is safe. It hasn't been revealed. Then it starts to get revealed in the body. That's already more in danger. But when it gets down to the point, which is the place of connection of man and woman in the world, which is what Yosef is. That's why Joseph, and that's why Yosef means to add, because that's where birth comes from. It means to make more. That's where birth is from. Yosef and Binyamin, the two parts of the bris, that's what they are. Yosef was the one who was able to withstand temptation in that area, and that's why it says Kabbalistically, the last generation of the history of the world will be one where the test is in that area, where that kind of immorality will be the absolute, where the absolute beauty of the loyalty of a Jewish marriage will be exposed and exploded in the world as such an immoral. The forces that will present that beauty in the world will present it as the most sensual, unbeautiful, stripped naked thing in the world. You follow? Exactly, because that's exactly what it shouldn't be. And that's the most dangerous area. That's the area where the negative forces, that's the area where the spiritual energies are so negative, where they are so attractive, especially for men, where they are so evil and so powerful that they almost cannot be withstood. From this you understand many things. That's why the contamination, the spiritual danger of Nida, the whole menstrual impurity idea, right? It's got nothing to do with cleanliness. It's because that area is so powerful that when it's in its phase of negativity, it's almost unstoppable. The reason actually Kabbalistically that we separate husbands from wives at that time, right, is because we want husband and wife to be together when the energies are spiritually as powerful as they could be. But if you put them together at a time when the energies are negative, tremendous destruction could be situated over there. And because it's that area which is the area where birth could happen, which is the most powerful, which is always that interface. When you go down, down, down to the bottom, it looks like destruction. That's where birth could happen. But at that moment of interface, that's where the greatest powers of evil always are. And that's why Yosef and Binyamin, Yosef was the one who was able to withstand that temptation. He was able to get into that zone of negativity where almost no one would have survived it. The Gemara says that he held on with his teeth and with his nails, he dug him into the ground to resist the temptation, and he almost couldn't, and he, just by the skin of his teeth, able to survive it, but he was able to do that, and he put that into the Jewish people. The power to go to the end, where only negativity reigns, where only temptation and disaster are, and at that stage to be able to maintain perfection. That's what Binyamin was. He was a child who was able to be in that area. He was a Mordechai who was able to be in that area. When it goes wrong, it looks like a Saul who doesn't quite make it and almost wipes out Amalek and doesn't quite manage it. That's the message. That's what Binyamin is. Naphtali is a thing we'll have to speak about another time. Naphtali is the tribe that comes at the end who has the power. Naphtali has the power to descend into that area and pull us out of it. Binyamin is the one who prevents us falling into that area. When the surroundings become that, Binyamin is so perfect that when the Jewish people are shielded by him, when another comes around, and we have the protection of a rear guard, that's a Binyamin, that's all the right hand side, that doesn't give any quarter at all to the left, to the forces of evil, so then we're protected. And even if you make a slip and you fall, and you absolutely happen to be in the clutches of a decree of destruction, then we have a Naphtali who's able to pull us out. That we'll have to discuss another time how that works. That's the message of Adam. It's a time when the year is dying, Nisan hasn't happened yet, the winter is not yet given way to spring. You see only the snow, you see only the ice, it's all freezing. So what happens? You don't see anything able even to break through the frozen ground. And that's a time when the destruction, tremendous danger for the Jewish people, where Moshe Rabbeinu dies in that month and decrees of destruction can be made against us. And in that month, what the Jewish people represent, there's an amazing power down at the bottom of the feet, the heels of the Jewish people. The time when all energy has been lost. At that time, we have an amazing gift of a power that could, in the midst of what looks like only the left-hand side, be only the right-hand side. The message is that what we have to do in terms of personality, which I appreciate, it's one beautiful thing, but to be able to apply it, is that we don't, as we've said many times before, we don't give in to despair. We don't give in to destruction. When it comes a date that Moshe Rabbeinu dies, we understand that he was born on that day. We are able to look through what looks like a despair, what looks like a destruction, what looks like tragedy. I mean, we don't have to rejoice in tragedy, but we're able to look beyond that and see that somehow that we're able to survive in that area. We're able to actually not just survive, but draw strength and draw geula. That means the ability to change what looks like sadness into happiness out of the times that look only negative.